Next case for argument is United States versus Gilbert, Mr. Schaum.
May it please the court, my name is Tim Schaum, and with me at council table is Gerald C. Peterson. We are here on behalf of the appellant, James Gilbert. Good morning.
Good morning.
I would also like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal. I think the clerk is aware of that. We are here because Mr. Gilbert was convicted on the sole count of being a felon in possession of a firearm. Mr. Gilbert does not appeal his conviction. However, Mr. Gilbert appeals his error, the sentence imposed on him by the district court, because his prior conviction for criminal confinement is not a violent felony, as that term is defined under the Armed Career Criminal Act, and the Act's sentence enhancement should not have applied to him. This morning, I'd like to make 3 points. The first point is that this court's decision in Hagenau is controlling authority in this case. It's on all fours with the facts and issues in this case, and it mandates vacating Mr. Gilbert's sentence. The second point is that Mr. Gilbert was convicted of Class D felony criminal confinement, which necessarily means no serious bodily injury occurred and no deadly weapon was used.
Could I stop you right there?
Yes, Your Honor.
Because what I think we have to talk about is Hagenau and Wallace sort of at the same time. Because whatever differences there are between the Illinois statute and the Indiana statute, this court in Wallace assumed that you might be able to restrain someone unlawfully under Illinois law through fraud, trickery, or deceit. Nonetheless, the court reasoned that the crime still presents a risk of injury because if the person discovers he's been tricked, he might try to leave, and force would then be required in order to restrain him. So why doesn't that same logic apply to the Indiana statute?
Well, it doesn't apply. The key reason it doesn't apply, Your Honor, is because the Illinois statute always contemplates categorically that a person is being restrained against his or her own will. That is, they want to leave. As this court found in Hagenau, that is not present in the Indiana statute of criminal confinement. Indeed, as this court stated in Hagenau, and I quote directly from the case, criminal confinement under Indiana law does not necessarily involve conduct that presents a serious potential risk of injury to another. One could, for example, confine another person without consent in a manner that, although unpleasant, does not present a serious potential risk of physical injury to another. And that's at 423 F3rd 644.
What would be an example of such a case?
Well, the hypothetical we presented in our brief and the Indiana case law that discusses such a case is a parent who unlawfully takes a child, although the child is willingly with the parent and no present for there is no danger of physical injury in that case, can still be guilty of criminal confinement. The statute also has fraud, false pretenses, and enticement.
You seem to assume that whenever you lure someone from one place to another by trickery, you commit criminal confinement, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. That's one way to do it.
So if I were to lure someone to a surprise party on false pretenses in Indiana, would I be committing criminal confinement?
Technically, yes. I doubt you'd be prosecuted.
Yeah, but
although
who knows?
Although we'd probably have to inform the House Judiciary Committee to consider the possibility of impeachment.
It's because I talked about Congress, isn't it, in the first case?
There's no criminal intent requirement.
Yeah, well, there is. It's knowingly or intentionally.
No. That's just knowledge of what you're doing. But is there some force in the words enticement or fraud that might distinguish Judge Rovner's case?
Uh, I don't think so. I mean,
do we know whether the number of surprise parties in Indiana dropped after this?
It will now.
I mean, one assumes that it's obviously with.
Are there cases under the enticement and fraud provision?
Yes, there are cases, Your Honor. I can't cite them by memory, but I did run across them, and they're in the...
This one, for example, since the state law claim against your client seems to have been based on fraud.
Well, that's
the... Frauding someone to move from the front of a house to the back. We just don't know what more details there were.
Exactly, and that brings me... That leads me...
Do we know anything about what actually happens in these cases? That is, if you look at Indiana's version of the uniform crime statistics, I mean, how many injuries result from criminal confinement violations?
Actually, Your Honor, I'm glad you asked that question because I listened to the oral argument in the Wallace case, and I understand that you had asked a similar question. My wife, who is a criminologist, enjoyed this research project, but unfortunately, the Indiana statute, it's so specific to Indiana, there's no uniform crime that breaks it down as far as criminal justice statistics.
And do Indiana's domestic statistics break it down?
Our research didn't find any breakdown.
And no criminologist or would-be criminologist in pursuit of a PhD has gathered up all the files where criminal confinement is charged and seen how often injury is associated with it?
None that we found,
there's
Your Honor.
There are PhD opportunities here not to be overlooked.
Inform my wife of that fact. But more
is this a kind of Interstate Mann Act or something like that? Is that what they're worried about? Kind of enticement they're worried about? Enticing a woman to a hotel room or something like that?
Well, I think it covers many possibilities, Your Honor, but the important point of what it doesn't cover necessarily is what this court found important in Wallace, which is restraining someone against his or her own will. That's not a necessary element of the statute. And more importantly, this is Class D felony criminal confinement, which means we know no serious bodily injury.
I don't think the Class D really gets you anywhere because you can certainly have a risk of injury or violence, even though it didn't materialize in a particular case.
Yes, that is true, Your Honor, but the point is it's not a categorical and a necessary risk. And in fact, we know that Class D felony criminal confinement does not necessarily present the risk of physical injury, as one Indiana court put in.
Well, I thought it was just that Class D, there was no injury.
Right. No injury resulted.
Right.
Correct. No serious bodily injury.
Yes.
That's correct.
So there still could be a risk.
You can have, you know, there are statutes that distinguish between, for example, when you shoot a gun at somebody and hit him, and when you shoot a gun at somebody and miss him. But the fact that you missed and no bodily injury resulted wouldn't mean that this was a crime without risk.
But, Your Honor, taking the categorical approach that the government advocates,
yes,
all
it's
we can...
just that it's completely irrelevant to do.
Taking the categorical approach, the crime I just mentioned, shooting at somebody with a gun and missing him, is a crime of violence because there's a substantial risk when you shoot at somebody that you'll hit him.
That's
even
correct,
though in
Your
a
Honor.
Given case you missed him.
Exactly, Your Honor. But when you take that same approach and define it to the four corners of the statute as written, it is not a categorical risk that physical injury will occur because when you entice someone, they come with you willingly. They are not coming. You're not detaining someone against his or her own will, which is a necessary part of the Illinois statute of unlawful restraint that was analyzed in the Wallace case, and which is why Hagenow controls and is not in conflict with any other precedent of this court.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Schell. Mr. Hanlon?
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the court, my name is James Hanlon. I'm an assistant U.S. attorney. I represent
Mr.
the government.
Hanlon, what
case.
Do we know about the data?
Your Honor, I don't know anything about that data.
Well, isn't that, I hate to use the word fatal when we're talking about crime of violence, but if there are no data, it's very difficult to see how fraud offenses, which this is, should be treated as crimes of violence. You know, you can imagine if it turned out that these kinds of things, you know, promising in a divorce situation, promising the mother that you'll just take daughter out for an outing to the grocery store and then you keep daughter for 2 days, that could lead to the mother coming and pursuing you, and violence might erupt. So you can imagine how violence follows from this, but without any empirical reason for concluding that that happens, seems to me very difficult to call it a crime of violence. We can't just take this out of the air. It's got to be based on something about the world.
I think that the answer to that lies in what Judge Rovner pointed out earlier, which, again, going back to the Wallace case, where the court analyzed the Illinois statute of unlawful restraint, the court there said that that crime can be committed, even though it doesn't expressly say
exactly,
it in the statutory language.
It was important, just as the Wallace opinion said, that it was against the will of the person being detained. Right? And people who are detained against their will have a tendency to try to fight their way out. All sorts of things can happen.
That's true.
That's not an element in Indiana. And that's what leads me to think that it matters what the data show. And you say the government is completely innocent of data, it doesn't care. Well, makes it awfully hard to go anywhere.
Well, Your Honor, respectfully, I think that the similarity to Wallace is identical, because in Wallace, even though the statutory language may be slightly different between the two laws, in Wallace, this court said unlawful constraint can be committed using trickery or deceit or fraud.
Just think about it. You defraud somebody in order to get them someplace, and you detain them against their will. That's a violation of the Illinois statute.
Correct.
When the person discovers he's being detained against his will, he may try to force his way out.
Which is exactly the case here.
That was the point of Wallace. But it's not an element of the Indiana statute.
Here's what could have happened in this case. Suppose Gilbert wanted to steal something from a store, which was in the front of the building. So he goes into the store, and he says to the storekeeper, someone is trying to steal your car in the parking lot at the back of the building. So the storekeeper rushes out. And then Gilbert gets cold feet, and he leaves, and he doesn't commit a burglary. But he has committed this crime of criminal confinement because he enticed the shopkeeper to the back of the building. In fact, he did it with a criminal intent. It's not like the surprise party. He did it with a criminal intent. So wouldn't that fit the statute perfectly well?
Yes.
Yes, and that's what might have happened. But in that situation, of course, you don't create any risk of injury to anybody.
That is true, but this court in Franklin expressly said the analysis that you don't use in looking at the categorical analysis of recidivist enhancement statutes is, can you postulate some hypothetical, as Mr. Gilbert does in his brief, some conceivable set of facts under which the crime can be committed in a nonviolent way?
That's why it matters what the normal way of committing this offense is and what the normal risks of that are. But you seem not to know what the normal way of committing the offense is and not to care what the normal risks of that way are.
Your Honor, I'm not sure I'm not following the court's question, because the court, I think it would be helpful to go back and look at the two statutes. The Illinois statute...
We're way beyond that.
About the purpose of this statute? Is this about children? Is this about, you know, custody disputes or what? The enticement fraud provision. What is that about?
Indiana does not keep legislative history.
Well, if you look at a sample of the prosecutions, right? If you go either to the state cases or to the court files and draw a sample of 50 of these prosecutions, what do they represent? What kinds of events are going on in these cases?
That I cannot answer. I can't answer in this particular case at pages 46 to 48.
Well, this particular case doesn't tell us what the norm is.
Well, it actually tells us more about what happened here, because in this particular case, at pages 46 to 48 of the appendix, in conjunction with the charging document in the criminal confinement case, there was a charging document in the domestic battery case. And those two documents, which both are part of the record and were before the district court in this case, show that Mr. Gilbert, on the same date, at the same place, punched the person who he removed from one place to another in the face. So at least in this case, while I can't answer the court's questions about empirical data on this topic, which I'd be happy to submit a post-hearing brief if the court thinks that's going to be controlling the analysis. We know in this case, without improperly looking behind the
document. You'll have to get a PhD.
Yeah, we're not entitled to know what's going on in this case. That's the holding of Shepard.
Your Honor, it's the
phase of
the
charging document. So
whatever
you may think about this case, we have to ignore. What we have to know is what is the norm for this category of cases. And about that, we apparently know nothing whatever.
Is merely luring, maybe this will help, is merely luring someone from one place to another through deceit enough to violate the Indiana statute, or is more required to make a criminal confinement?
Luring through deceit would violate the statute, and I would submit to the court that this is very similar to a situation such as in United States versus Gardner, where this court held that residential entry under Indiana law, without evaluating any empirical data, said that simply walking into someone's house without their authorization is a crime of violence. And that goes back to the categorical analysis of the possibility of violent confrontation.
By the way, on your view of the statute, how many times has Judge Rovner violated it? She often gives surprise parties.
Well,
in Illinois, exclusively, I assume.
So it
is a surprise to me.
It is like the Gardner case where going knowingly and intentionally going to someone's house is a crime of violence. I think it's also similar to United States versus Bryan and the cases like that where this court has held that all escapes, even nonviolent walkaways from no security prison camps, are violent because the possibility of violence.
This point about this other information, that's not in your brief, is it?
Your Honor, that is not in our brief. That is not our central argument.
Wait. Not your central argument. What do you mean not your central argument? It was peripheral in your brief or wasn't referred to at all?
It is not referred to in the brief. It is in the record. This
it's not your argument at all.
On any
right?
basis.
I mean, you can't bring it up at oral argument for the first time.
Your Honor, it's my understanding.
Especially you were so emphatic in your brief that the judge had not done anything improper because he had just looked at the charging document for this offense, for the unlawful confinement, criminal confinement. Now you're saying, no, there was something else there for the judge to look at.
Your Honor, I brought that up in response to Judge Easterbrook's question about other cases.
What brought it up
other
in
cases.
Response to?
And
it's
this
not
court,
your argument.
Well, this court can affirm on any basis, and even
well,
if...
Wait a second. Affirm on any basis when you have... I mean, usually the way that issue comes up is the appellee says, well, look, you know, the judge ruled on this, but you can affirm on this other ground because it was presented to the judge so that the other party had notice of it. You can't just spring it out of your hat at oral argument when the defendant had no opportunity to meet it, and when it contradicts what you say in your brief.
Your Honor, even if the district court had looked at the other charging document I referred to, that would not violate Shepard. The point of Shepard is that you can't look
the
behind charging documents.
The point is, you can't bring the argument up at this stage. You should have thought about it earlier and put it in your brief.
Your Honor, the government's argument is that categorically that the court...
No, I understand that argument. I don't understand your new argument, which is that there's enough here in documents that Shepard permits to show that this was a crime of violence.
Well, as I said, the government's argument is that categorically it's a crime of
violence. But what you
violence.
Want us to do is overrule Hagenow. That's your main argument.
That's true, Your Honor. And if I might end on that point very briefly, I see I'm out of time, and if I might just finish with this one last point, is that Hagenow actually can be distinguished from Wallace on the basis that in Hagenow, the issue before the court was not whether the Illinois offense was a crime of violence. The issue was whether the district court violated the defendant's Sixth Amendment rights by the methodology the court
used.
Why does
it help you to distinguish Hagenow from Wallace?
The reason because
I thought your argument was that Hagenow is inconsistent with Wallace.
That is true, and the reason why I bring that
up. Well, if they're inconsistent, how can they be distinguished? I don't get that.
Your Honor, the reason why I bring that up is because the government's point is that regardless of whether this court expressly overrules Hagenow, which the government thinks it should, the court could distinguish Hagen out, but at least include language in the opinion in this case stating that the offending language in Hagen out, which is inconsistent with Wallace, is dicta. That was not central to the issue before the court. In the Hagenau case, the court remanded because the court improperly looked behind the charging document at the probable cause affidavits. So the point is that the government would request that the panel, irrespective of how it gets to its conclusion, make it known for harmony in this area of the law that the language and the government's request is exactly what happened in the Howes case, in which Judge Easterbrook overruled, or the panel in that case overruled part of United States versus Lee on the basis that it failed to apply the categorical approach.
Okay, thank you, Mr.
Thank you,
Mr. Allen. Mr. Shum, how much time does he have? 2 minutes. Is there anything further?
Yes, Your Honor, it's very briefly. I think Judge Rovner hit it on the head when she said, what is the minimal criminal conduct necessary to sustain a conviction under the statute, which is exactly the analysis that needs to be conducted. We're not out here postulating some impossible factual hypothetical. We're looking at the face of the statute. The government has asked this court to reverse itself without analysis, without analyzing the individual statutes. And when you actually look at the underlying statutes in Wallace and in Hagenau, the same one at issue here, they're materially different. No matter how you commit unlawful restraint in Illinois, you are necessarily going to have to be detaining someone against his or her own will. That was the focus in Wallace, and that is why this court held that unlawful restraint in Illinois law is a violent felony. In contrast, in Hagenau, criminal confinement can be committed in several nonviolent methods that do not pose a necessary risk of physical injury, and that is why in Hagenau this court found that criminal confinement under Indiana law is not a violent felony under the Armed Career Criminal Act. Mr. Gilbert respectfully requests that this court vacate his sentence and remand his case for resentencing.
Thank you. Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Shum. And you
thank
were
you
appointed,
much,
were you?